You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Shaddy.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Not bad. Yeah. No. I mean, well, it's a crazy time to be alive. So not great
Isn't
in
it?
Terms of the world, but, you know.
You've noticed that too. And you're in what? Were you in Washington?
I am indeed.
Unfortunately,
the heart of the empire.
Yeah. Now Trump's out of town, so maybe things are kind of placid there. But
true.
And I should say we're actually recording this a week or two before people will see it. And let me introduce this before I say more. So I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Shaddy Hamid, co-founder of Wisdom of the Crowds, or Wisdom of Crowds?
Wisdom of Crowds.
Of Crowds podcast. Also a columnist at the Washington Post, author of a number of books, including the one we're going to discuss, the brand new book, The Case for American Power. Parts of which I disagree with. So this should be a lively and I hope illuminating conversation. So let me start with this. So it's an argument that, as I understand it, correct me whenever I get anything wrong, but it's an argument that it's important for the U.S. to remain the world's dominant power and be willing to exercise power, certainly including military power. And you say that this is more your view than it used to be. You, for a time, you were more of a skeptic of the use of American power, but you've changed. So maybe one way to give people a sense for the kind of thing you're talking about is to tell us a position you held before this conversion, if that's not too dramatic a word, that you wouldn't hold now, or something, a position you took on an issue maybe involving intervention or something, that you wouldn't take now. Give us an example of how you have changed in concrete terms.
Well, I should say the conversion is not recent. So the conversion happened after college, grad school, when I was in college at Georgetown. So also here in DC, I was kind of your traditional pseudo-socialist leftist critic of American empire. I saw America as, in some ways, like the font of evil in the world. Maybe evil is pushing it a little bit, but that the U.S. caused havoc and destruction wherever it went. It still does do that sometimes, of course, and we'll get to that. So it's more of a nuanced
We definitely will, believe me.
Yes. But I think that my tendency at that time was always to blame America first, to feel like we were fundamentally bad and that we had to be restrained in the world and that it was better for other powers to play prominent roles in the kind of global arena. And in that sense, I was kind of the Noam Chomsky school of thought. I mean, I kind of saw him as my foreign policy guru. I think he was right about a lot of things, but also wrong about other things. And we'll talk about that, I suppose. But I think that I was pretty much what a lot of people go through in college or in their younger years, where there's this sense of wanting to be a revolutionary, a radical, and to kind of focus a lot of our attention, almost exclusively our attention, on our own faults and failures, while kind of elevating other cultures or other nations or other powers and saying that they are better than us. Now I'm proud to be American, and anyway, I'll just leave it at that. We can unpack that.
Okay.
So I at that time, I just wanted America to stop doing things in the world.
Yeah, that might be an improvement, actually, but that's just me. So, but let's take a concrete example. So, and maybe this will help us locate the time of the change of view. Did you support the Iraq War before the invasion?
No, fundamentally against it. I was active in the anti-war movement. That's kind of how I cut my teeth as an activist, really. So I was one of those people who was going in front of the White House and organizing die-ins and teach-ins on campus. That was really how I came of age politically. This was all post 9/11. So I think 9/11 and the Iraq War were the two key moments in my political evolution. And I mean, everything that I am now is at least in part because of those moments and what they meant for me. So I hated the Iraq War. I thought it was, I didn't think it was so much malevolent as it was stupid. And I don't know if that's worse or better or something in between. I don't think that George W. Bush was waking up every morning and desiring to like take the blood of Iraqis and make them suffer. I don't think it was like that, but I think it was, it doesn't have to be malevolent to be as destructive as it was. And it was quite destructive. And we've been living with the effects of that since.
Well, this is kind of funny, unless I misunderstand you, because there are a lot of people say, yeah, I supported the Iraq War, but that just didn't go well. Now I've seen the light. I'm more of a skeptic of the use of American power. So how did, did the Iraq War, do you look back at the Iraq War and say I was foolish to oppose that?
No, I'm still, still 100% opposed to it. I think the evolution with me, I sort of, first of all, there was this, you might recall this one day of protest that was coordinated across the globe in major cities all over the place. And you had, you know, millions of people. I think it was February 2003. And I was a part of that mass mobilization. There was a sense that the people were standing up and we were organizing, and that if we had enough people power, we might be able to stop the war. And then the war happened. So I think I went through a kind of disillusionment phase of trying to ask myself, how was it that the people were against this all over, in major capitals all over the world, including in London, Paris, you name it. Yet the war still happened. And then one of the conclusions I reached is that you had a group of people around George W. Bush, let's call them the neocons.
Let's do.
Yeah. Knew each other in grad school, were sort of ideologically committed to a particular, somewhat unusual cause. And they were able to capture the levers of American power. So one of the lessons I drew from that was I didn't want to any longer be on the outside looking in. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life as an activist. I wanted to be closer to power. And I wanted the people who shared my concerns to be in positions of power in the future. That's when it started to shift, the sense that power is not something that maybe attains us in some ways, but it's also inevitable. It's something that we have to aspire to because there's no other option. And that if America is the most powerful country in the world, which it was at that time and which I believe it still is now, then we should hope that it uses its power in better, more moral, more just ways. And to kind of exit the political game and say, America is bad, it foregoes our responsibility as citizens. And it's just an untenable position to hold. And that's where I think I became very frustrated with the activists left, this sense that they could just wash their hands of power or the idea of power and just be morally pure. I didn't want to be morally pure anymore.
Okay, but I don't see how that implies a change of position on how America should behave. I see how it informs how you should behave. It might make you say, well, I should be in a think tank. I should whatever. And you actually were eventually. I remember you were at Brookings for a while. I forget when exactly that was, but it wasn't that long after the Iraq War.
It wasn't. I was there up until 2 years ago.
Okay. But I mean, you take my point, right? I first of all, I agree with you. I mean, the insight dawned on you much earlier than it did on me that in this fallen world, it's all about power. If you want to change things, you need power. There are a lot of forms of power. Popular protest is a form of power in a certain sense, but you got to have power. But that realization has not led me to change my views about how badly America has tended to exercise military power, or my view about how we needed different system of maintaining world order than relying on America. So why is your view on that change?
Well, I started to see examples of how American power could be used for good quite early on, actually. And you'll probably disagree with some of this, but you know, George W. Bush was not totally bad. He had some good ideas, and one of them was the so-called freedom agenda. And as someone who has always, my one consistent thing from day one, pretty much from when I was a teenager onwards, was I wanted the U.S. to stop supporting dictatorships in the Middle East. So this was the mark of our hypocrisy, that we claimed to support democracy abroad, but we did the opposite in practice. Mm-hmm. And finally, it was George W. Bush who started to speak out against that practice. And he had a number of speeches around 2003 and 2004, where he actually said some pretty inspiring things about how Arabs are capable of, I mean, it's not, well, it's a low bar, but considering who came, what was said subsequently about Arabs and their capability for democracy, George W. Bush was very much of the view that this was a universal thing that was in the reach of all peoples. Mm-hmm. And that Arabs deserve to be free just like anyone else. And it was quite rousing. And then he started to put pressure on these.
Can I interrupt just to locate you? You're of Egyptian descent. Were you born in Egypt?
No. I'm born and raised in Pennsylvania. Okay. But I'm original. My parents are Egyptian. Yeah.
Okay.
So we would go to Egypt in the summers, and I would, I could see firsthand that there was this dictatorship that was in place. It ended up being in place for 30 years, and that we were the primary military patron of it. So that was something that was evident to me. And George W. Bush was someone who claimed to want to change that. And he did start putting pressure on some of these regimes. And he was using American power to do so. He was threatening to withhold aid. He was promising to increase aid if countries improve their human rights records, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I started to see that the picture of the George W. Bush legacy was actually more mixed than I originally thought. The Iraq War obviously looms in front of all of this, but I mean, I will say, and I don't want to go down like a rabbit hole on this per se, but I do think that Iraq is better off now than it would have been under Saddam. That doesn't justify the Iraq War itself, but it just offers a little bit of nuance. So it's not as, you know, I don't see the Iraq War as being nearly as evil as our support for Israel in the Gaza War, just for comparison's sake. And I think that the U.S. often does terrible things with good intentions. We're not trying to hurt people, as I sort of alluded to earlier, where I think Israeli leaders were waking up, you know, maybe not every morning, but at least some mornings, and thinking to themselves, oh, let's actually hurt more Palestinians. I don't think that the U.S. necessarily does that as much.
Well, but there's no excuse for it saying it wasn't doing that during the Gaza War. We were aware that those were our weapons, and we could cut off the flow, and we had the power to get Israel to stop. We had that much leverage.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Biden chose not to. Trump chose not to for a long time. So I don't think, I take your point that the Iraq invasion was done without the kind of real-time knowledge of the degree of harm that would be done, unlike Gaza. But, let me just say, it seems to me a lot of your argument is premised on the idea that America is just better than Russia and China in senses we can get into. And that's why you think we should hold the mantle of power. And I just have to, you're clearly aware of the challenge that the Gaza experience poses to your thesis. You refer to that in the book, but it seems like pretty bad. Right.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, the book is my attempt to reckon with the legacy of Gaza, and it's mm-hmm. front and center in the early chapters. And the book isn't entirely about Gaza, so it's certainly possible that I could have talked about it more. But part of the writing of the book and the revising of the book was to try to make sense of where things were at and to try to see if I could sort of sustain my love for America despite all of its faults, because Gaza really did challenge me in that regard. And I had to ask myself, was I comfortable telling progressives, young Americans, Arabs, Muslims, was I comfortable making the case for American power? You know, it's in the title of the book, so I'm pretty straight up about it. Was I comfortable mm-hmm. making that case to them? And there were times when I wondered if I was. And I had doubts about the book at certain points. But I knew what my principles were. And I knew that our support for Israel in Gaza was not a structural reality. That was not an intrinsic element of the use of American power. If anything, we weren't using our power. You mentioned that Biden failed to put pressure on Israel to stop the war. That was an abdication of our power, not evidence of using it. So no, in that sense, it is
a decades-long tradition in that case, and it makes you wonder, right? I mean, we virtually never use significant leverage on Israel.
But we can. And I think part of what I'm trying to argue is that not only that we should, but that we can. And to the extent that we don't, that's a product of our choices as Americans. We get the government we deserve. We get the policies we mm-hmm. deserve. So if we don't like our foreign policy, if we don't like what our leaders were doing in Gaza supporting the Israeli government, then we have to vote for different leaders. And that's part of what I'm trying to, if I may use the word, inspire younger Americans to do, is to say, don't lose faith in the American project. You have to continue believing in America and American power, because if you don't, then you're ceding the ground to people who don't really have any moral values when it comes to these questions. And they're not the ones who should be holding power. We're the ones who should be holding power. So we can't kind of, you know, step back in this Chomskyan approach and say, well, it's better to be morally pure and to write op-eds in The Nation or wherever it might be. No, we have to be engaging directly in politics, in the mainstream kind of political combat, and trying to change our policies through those means, through our democratic means. And this brings us, I think, to
wait. These people, they vote. They go to protests. They just disagree with you. I mean, they would go to a protest saying America should not be throwing its weight around the world. You would say America should. But can I just get back to the question I was trying to, like, the book is basically, look, America is manifestly better than China and Russia. Yes. Maybe you're saying you agree. You're saying that. And you just said, well, yeah, America could have used its leverage with Israel in recent decades to keep it from doing various bad things.
Yes.
But it didn't. Well, okay. But if it didn't for decades, how is it manifestly bad? I mean, if its whole history of conduct is bad, I don't know. Okay, it's fine to say we've been super, super, super bad for a long time, but we can change. I agree, we could
but
change.
Gaza is just one part of the overall picture. Gaza is very important to me, but it is not the entire picture of what America mm-hmm. is. We can't define the American idea based on what the Biden administration and then the Trump administration did in these last couple of years. I don't think that's quite the right way to look at it. America is a much vaster idea than that, whether we're looking at our own domestic conduct. And I mean, because part of the argument for why we're better than the available alternatives is because of how we conduct ourselves at home. We are a democracy. That means we're morally superior. I'm willing to say that. So going even further than what you said, manifestly better, not only are we manifestly better, we are superior in a deeply moral sense.
Can I just say, but don't you consider our external conduct in the world as part of the, in determining how, quote, good we are? It's good to be a democracy. I agree, if you can make it work, which we're not really doing now, but if you can make democracy work, keep it a liberal democracy, that's good. That work, that goes on the positive side of the ledger. But if you're asking me, what sense does being good qualify a nation to dominate the world? I would put a lot of emphasis on our conduct toward other nations. And there I would say, I'm sorry, I just don't think it's clear that we're better than Russia or China. Well, and that is something I'd like to get back to.
Let's
I'm not talking about human rights. Yes. I'm talking about conduct toward the world?
Well, let's fill out the kind of ledger a little bit and do a kind of accounting of our deeds, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. America doesn't always do bad things. I want to be very clear about
that. I didn't say it all. I didn't say that.
I know, but some folks on the left, I don't think it's hyperbole to say that there is a sense on the further left that when America acts, it acts badly. There is something about American power or America as an idea, even from the founding onwards, that makes us do, we're an empire, and empires are inevitably destructive and so forth. But if you look at, so at the close of World War II, out of all countries in the world, only about 8% were democracies. By the time we get to the 1990s, 50% of the world's countries are democracies. What happens in the interim period? The U.S. rises as a dominant power. The U.S. is promoting certain ideals. During the Cold War, we supported right-wing dictatorships in Latin America, Africa, Asia, God knows where else. We certainly did mm-hmm. that. And the book includes a full accounting of those sins. I have an entire chapter on hypocrisy. So I'm very serious about taking all of that into account. But it's also true that we started putting pressure on those right-wing dictatorships in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, somewhat during the Carter administration. And those regimes started to fall, and we started to see transitions to democratic rule. The U.S. supported that. The U.S. helped make that possible. So we can't understand why half of the world became democratic without understanding that the world superpower was also democratic. If the Soviet Union had won out in the Cold War, we wouldn't have seen the same kind of democratic explosion, what Samuel Huntington called the third wave of democratization. These things aren't coincidental.
That's a whole argument. I mean, you know, causality in these things is really hard. I mean, I know, for example, in your book, you attribute the relative dearth of war after World War II to the U.S. being the dominant power. Well, another thing happened at the end of World War II, nuclear weapons. And of course, that made war between great powers insanity. And some people would say that was the main factor. So these things are complicated. And I know you attribute a lot of good in the world to things America does, but I think it's a pretty complicated story. But I certainly don't know enough, really, even to argue with you about the what you just said.
In the last couple of years, we've seen an uptick in battlefield deaths largely because of two wars that are going on. I would posit to you that it's not a mistake that has happened, just as the perception of American power, the perception that American power has declined. I mean, that is the sense that a lot of our competitors have. And there's a sense that it's kind of open season for people who want to do malign things. And certainly Russia perceives it that way. And certainly China does. It's no mistake that Russia and China
What wars has China started?
Since I just mean becoming more aggressive towards Taiwan, for example. I'm not saying necessarily the outbreak of an actual war, but China's increasingly hawkish posture in the world has come with the sense that American power is declining, and they see an opportunity to fill in the gap.
No, I think that's true. I think rising powers tend to feel their oats and behave the way we behaved 100, 120, 130 years ago. Spanish-American War and so on, rising power. We exerted military force much further abroad than China has dreamed of. That is the way emerging powers act. But if we're talking about which countries have most egregiously violated what I consider the bedrock of international law, which is against transborder aggression, against the invasion of the bombing of other countries that haven't attacked you, I would submit that the U.S. is a worse offender over the last 40, 50 years than Russia or China. So, and I think
really, you'd say worse than Russia during the Cold War. I mean,
Let's think about it.
I mean, if we think about the entire Iron Curtain, I mean, the fact that there were all these
satellites. I said the last 40, 50 years. So, I mean, I don't know what is that, I don't know what that covers, but I was mainly thinking post-Cold War, actually. But, we, you know, our hands were not clean during the Cold War. And it depends, you know, I mean, Reagan was fighting proxy wars in other countries. You know, we're sending arms in, and you may or may not consider that a violation of the UN Charter, but it is a form of transborder aggression. Anyway, we've done a lot of just textbook violations since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, but if you want to take sort of what I consider to be the textbook example of imperial aggression over the past couple of decades, I would say it's Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I don't think that the U.S. has done anything quite like that. I don't think the Iraq War qualifies at that same level. I mean, we can just, maybe it's a debate about what's worse and what's slightly better and all of that. And maybe that's not the best debate to have.
I would call both of those very clear-cut violations of the UN Charter. It,
right.
By the way, Taiwan is not considered a sovereign country even by us. I think that's a more complicated case. But anyway, that aggression, I mean,
but look,
war
I think
hasn't
that
happened.
We also have to acknowledge that Russia and China are considerably weaker than the U.S. now. Imagine if they did become an empire, the dominant power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would see some pretty destructive things happening. If China had free rein to do whatever it wanted, God forbid, I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to even test that out. And that's part of why I'm afraid of this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy of decline, that we're so convinced that we're declining as Americans that we allow the decline to continue and don't resist it. You know, so I think that it's hard to know what the counterfactual is. I'm making an argument, at least in part, one of my arguments can't be proven, which is that China would be worse if it was an empire of the sort that America is today. Because at least under the American Empire, we did have something called the liberal world order, the liberal rules-based order. We did have a set of institutions that were doing quite well up until quite recently. You know, the whole institutions around Bretton Woods, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, the list goes on. I mean, the U.S. did do good things in the creating a kind of post-war order where things could be a little bit more predictable and regularized, and countries could actually not dedicate themselves to war. The obvious case here being the European nations who were under an American security umbrella, and they were able to pursue peace and prosperity, at least within what would become the European Union. That would not have been possible without America's security umbrella that we were providing to them. So again, when we're looking at the ledger of good deeds and bad deeds, there are things that are maybe so obvious that they're often not remarked upon. The European project would not have been possible without America's role post-World War II. We can talk about the Marshall Plan. I mean, it's really
I like
a long...
I like the Marshall Plan. Well, Marshall Plan's fine. I like that we established the UN. I like the World Trade Organization. In fact, this is one difference between, I think, my worldview and yours is I think if there's a world we need to move toward, it is toward more in the way of international institutions that have binding effect on the behavior of nations. You know, we kind of faltered. I mean, the world faltered at some point over the last 20 years or so when for a while it was like looking like, yeah, maybe it'd get there. WTO was kind of an unprecedented organization in the extent to which you know, it adjudicated trade disputes and so on. I'm in favor of all that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying the U.S. has played no constructive role since World War II. Certainly, I like a lot of the institution building. That's all fine. But a good example of something we disagree on is you're saying, God, imagine how China would behave if they were as dominant as we are, which is, first of all, not all that dominant, right? I mean, we have to respect America right now, as a practical matter, has to recognize that China and Russia have nuclear weapons and China is, you know, has a lot of money and so on. But I think it is so common to assume in American discourse pretty broadly, and I think this accounts for the rise of China hawkism, that China would misuse power in certain ways if it could. And to be honest, I think that's projection to some extent.
It already has. I mean, it's committed a genocide against the Uyghur Muslims within its own borders. I mean, we have to count certain things.
Wait, was that worse than Gaza? Was that worse than Gaza, the thing we just did? Was that worse than Gaza?
To be fair, we're not the ones who actually committed the genocide against the Gazan people.
Let me tell you, less forgivable because we were not threatened in the way that Israel. It's understandable that Israel, in its situation, overreacts to things. It's there. And it's a precarious position if you view it the way Israelis do. I understand that. We have no excuse. We have no excuse for acting insanely. Supporting the.
I agree with you on that, and I've been outspoken on that. But I think it's also fair to say that the U.S. does not go around currently committing genocides. It's not something that we do.
Well, we just collaborated on one. That's the way I look at what happened. I mean, let me be clear. I use the word genocide conservatively. I have not actually personally applied it to either Gaza or the Uyghurs. But I would say both were super bad. And it's far from clear to me that what China did is worse than what we did.
But I'm just saying that the U.S. doesn't do that within its own borders. And that goes back to the fact that we're a democracy. We don't conduct mass killings of our own people. And I don't see us doing that anytime soon. Because we are fundamentally different in how we're organized domestically, mm-hmm. democratically, and constitutionally, that can't help but have some effect on what we do abroad. That we actually at least pretend, even if we're not always doing it well or doing it at all, we at least pretend to be better than we actually are. We used to, until Donald Trump, talk consistently about the importance of human rights and democracy abroad. We honored those values in the breach a lot of the time. So we were hypocritical, no doubt. But at least there was an aspiration to something better. China doesn't aspire to any of that. China doesn't even pretend to be better than it actually is, which is not good at all, I would say. I mean, and that's why I'm
Of course it does. I mean, it does. It actually does speak more high-mindedly about its aspirations than the cynical reality justifies, just as we do. So, I mean, it does try. I don't know what you mean.
Donald Trump,
our president is the one who doesn't try.
He's the one who just said,
fuck, I want to kill him. They're dead.
That's why I said up until Donald Trump. I mean, there has been an American bipartisan tradition of having the promotion of democracy be at least a part of our foreign policy. Mm-hmm. China doesn't have anything in its foreign policy that's dedicated to promoting democracy or human rights abroad. They mm-hmm. actually don't want to see too much democracy or human rights abroad because then their own citizens might realize that there are alternatives to the rule of the Chinese Communist Party. So it's understandable mm-hmm. from the standpoint of the Chinese. And that's where the domestic organization of a state has some relevance to how it conducts itself abroad. We can't completely separate and say, well, China is really bad at home towards its own people, but it's actually pretty good outside of its own borders. I don't think that distinction can really hold.
I think we actually have to make a clear distinction in our policy, but go ahead.
Yeah, I just think that naturally how a country sees itself at home will affect how it sees what it does abroad. And that's why in the book I try to go, you know, pretty chronologically and talk about how different presidents have perceived the moral mission of America. We were founded on a moral mission. That makes us, you know, pardon the cliche, but we are exceptional. There's very few countries that are founded on the ideals of democracy, freedom, liberty, and so forth, and countries that are committed to supporting those abroad at even if they don't always do it. I mean, France is maybe the only country that universalizes its own domestic ideals, but Germany doesn't really have a foreign policy that is about promoting democracy abroad, or Sweden or Norway.
Our policy isn't really about that. We just say that. You know that.
Yes, but we have at times supported democracy. I just gave you, I mean, the list
sure,
of
when it's in, convenient. Yeah. I think you're right. Bush actually had religion for a couple of years, leaving aside the question of whether the people who encouraged that in him were themselves cynical in their aspirations. But
yeah, there was a first Arab Spring in 2000.
It has not been the rule that we do that, So
yeah, but
I don't know what again, it matters what the founders said, honestly. And I'm not sure they said that, but go ahead.
We promoted, not to go again, go to the end of the Cold War, but I'm just saying when we're looking at cases like Guatemala, Brazil, Chile, you know, South Korea, the Philippines, the U.S. did put pressure on those autocratic regimes in the 1980s, and that made something mm-hmm. possible that was better, so on and so forth. I should also say that the use of military intervention can be salutary as well. I mean, Kuwait, Bosnia, Kosovo, you're not going to like this, but I would put Libya in that category, which I still strongly support.
I didn't even like Kosovo, but we can come back to that. And I'm not sure what else you mentioned, but no.
We stopped. I mean,
yeah,
there have been cases where, there was mass killing or an invasion or an occupation of a sovereign state. Mm-hmm. Such as in Iraq towards Kuwait during the first Gulf War. And the U.S. was the only country that was capable of stopping those things from happening. There was a sense at that time in the global community, someone has to stop this. Who will stop this? And the answer is always America. There is no other option. If we're looking at any kind of effort to stop mass killing, Syria, I was extremely, and I talk about this in the book too, I was very critical of the Obama administration for failing to use our military power when it mattered for Syrians, when we could have stopped the mass killing. And God knows, how the history of the region could have changed at that time and the history of Syria. Thankfully, Syria is now the lone bright spot in the Middle East, but it took a long time to get there. And after hundreds of thousands of people were killed. So Barack Obama said he had red lines, as we all know. He didn't live up to those red lines. But America was the last best hope that Syrians had for stopping their own killing. America is the first and last line of defense when mass slaughter is happening.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
But I'm just saying, who's capable of stopping a mass slaughter besides America?
Let me back up, say
okay,
something
sure.
about China. I definitely want to get to Syria, but you said, look at what, China has done to the Uyghurs. America would never do that to its own people. Actually, during World War II, America rounded up every American citizen of Japanese descent and interred them, took away their liberty. Okay. Now you may say, but that was war. That's serious shit. Now, do you really think that that Beijing does not consider the nationalist, the secessionist movement in the West an actual national security threat? Now, I think they're overdoing it. Yeah. I mean, I think they're exaggerating the threat, and I don't approve of the way they're responding. They're handling the threat anyway. I don't approve of what they did to the Uyghurs. I think America was overreacting to the possibility that some Japanese American would, I don't know what they were even imagining would happen. But so I think they overreacted. I don't approve of what they did, but I would say.
But also putting aside the Uyghurs, China suppresses every single citizen of China is suppressed. They don't have basic rights to express themselves or to vote in elections.
You said we would never do something like what they did to the Uyghurs. I said, actually, we did. Do you think my example
valid? I mean, I think what happened to Japanese Americans was atrocious. I don't think we can draw a moral equivalency between what China did to the Uyghurs and the scale of the million plus people who were affected by that. Compared to what we did briefly to Japanese Americans. And I think, I'm just worried about the moral equivalence of saying these things are equal, right? That's what I'm just trying to get at here. But I did say currently, I'm just saying that the U.S. in its current manifestation, and I made sure to use that word earlier, we are not a country that does that. And no, I'm speaking sure Trump in the
would
present
never do,
tense.
I'm sure Trump would never do that kind of thing. But we'll see. But let me emphasize, to my mind, that part of the argument is not as important as it is to you. Because, again, one of the differences us and me and apparently pretty much everyone is that, you know, I think America should focus on the external conduct of other nations. That really was the core idea behind the United Nations. You know, the United Nations, it has the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's fine. Beautiful document. I support it. I think we should support human rights in various ways. However, if you look at the actual mechanism in the UN that had power, what could the security do? It could do things in response to countries using military aggression against other countries. That's what the actual machinery of the UN was designed to do. And in that sense, it was kind of a realist institution. And that, I personally think, look, I would love to make everything better everywhere and solve all the world's human rights problems. By and large, America's attempts to do that over the last 40 years, it seems to me, have been either ineffectual or counterproductive for the most part.
So let's get better at doing that. If that is, in fact, the goal that we share, as you said, it would be great if we could make the world better. I'm trying to offer a roadmap of how we can do that. I don't see an alternative. Now, I think the only alternative people really have is to say, hey, the world is a bad place, bad shit happens, and we got to just kind of accept that as the reality of life as we know it. I'm not willing to say that. And when I look at the available options for promoting the better world that I envision, and I'm not even saying, I'm putting aside the argument that we're morally better than China or Russia, I think you would agree with me that China is not going to be the vehicle for creating a more just global situation. That's not what China is aspiring to do. China doesn't even claim to want to do that. So if the goal is...
That's not true. That's just what China does claim to do is want a peaceful and stable world. And I do think they might be better than that at us, better at that than us. Could
peaceful
they be
and
worse?
Stable,
I mean,
to
honestly,
me doesn't read the same as a more democratic, free,
no, it's not
just
the same
world.
It's not the same aspiration. At the same time, I think the common assumption that China's goal is to squash democracies and remake the world in its image, I think there is no evidence of that. And I think it is a case of projection because we ourselves do want to do that. We want to remake the world in our image. And we have used violence a number of times on grounds that the country didn't comport with our idea of the way countries should conduct their internal affairs. That's what I'm against. Unless, look, there are extreme cases, the Holocaust and so on, where any humane person would intervene. But by and large, the moralistic foreign policy that doesn't distinguish between the way nations conduct their internal affairs and the way they behave toward other nations, I think is a huge mistake. And not just because I'm claiming we've been, you know, egregiously hypocritical on that front. I mean, you just said we could improve. Yeah, we could improve. But
so then
I just
the question
think,
I would have to you is, what is your roadmap for doing that? Because if you don't think America is capable of doing so, or that we're just so morally imperfect that we'll never be able to improve upon ourselves, then what's the alternative exactly?
I mean, to be honest, I think my worldview has about as much chance of being realized as yours, which is not much. Like it's like your worldview is like what you're saying is America has to be the dominant force. I know we have not by and large demonstrated that that would be a good idea. Well, I mean, you wouldn't put it that way, but you would admit that, look, okay, granted, you know, we haven't been a great country, but we can become better. Well, okay, maybe, but
so let's try.
But let me just tell you, my view is that, like you mentioned, the Persian Gulf War, that was fine because it was a legal war in the sense of international law. Bush went to the Security Council, he got approval, perfectly legal war, classic use of the United Nations machinery. There was transborder aggression, we rolled it back, we had the authorization of the Security Council, great. I think we had the opportunity after the Cold War to make that paradigmatic. and to cultivate the norm of respect for international law. And as you may remember, there were people who thought George H.W. Bush, you know, he was kind of talking about, you remember the New World Order and that freaked out the sovereigntist right and who thought it meant black helicopters and stuff. Now, unfortunately, even he, and honestly, I don't think there's been a president since then whose foreign policy I necessarily prefer to his on balance, but even he invaded Panama illegally. And Clinton's intervention in Kosovo was flatly illegal and drove Russia crazy in ways very few
people understand. Something can be illegal but still be moral, right?
Well, okay, let's talk about Kosovo. Do you realize that we did exactly what we're complaining about Russia doing in Ukraine, which is bomb civilian infrastructure, bomb power centers, blah, blah, blah. And when we did that, there was a transcript where a NATO spokesman says, they complained about it, and he says, look, if the Serbian people don't like it, they can overthrow their ruler. I mean, this is just collective punishment, and it's such a good example of our hypocrisy. But in any event, from my point of view, the main thing is it was an illegal war. Could an illegal war do good? Of course. And I could, and let me just finish, wait. I could do illegal things that could do good. I could break into a store and get something that somehow saved the life of somebody. Still, we arrest people who break into stores, and that's the way it is with the law generally, is that you just say, look, yeah, of course, in some individual cases, it was with the best of intentions or even with the best of effects. But we have to have the principle that you can't go around breaking the law. I think we have to make the planet like that. And this is where I say, look, maybe my vision is as hopeless as yours, you know, like you're expecting the U.S. to finally become a good nation. And I'm expecting people to what? Suddenly abide by international law. Look, it's a tough, hard slog, but I do think right after the Cold War, you were pretty damn young, actually.
I was barely alive during the Cold War.
You were a tyke. So let me tell you, I was at the New Republic. I was acting editor of the New Republic in 1989. And I'm here to tell you, the U.S. had tremendous normative power. Tremendous normative power. For this to work, for us to really cultivate respect for international law and say, like, see what happened in with Kuwait, that can't happen, you know, you would have had to have at least several enlightened presidents, like a Bush who doesn't invade Panama, a Clinton who doesn't do Kosovo, a George W. Bush who doesn't do Iraq. It didn't happen. But I do think it was possible at that moment. And in the long run, I do not see an alternative to global governance for reasons we haven't even gotten into having to do with technology. But I've talked a lot. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Well, I would maybe just disagree a little bit with the claim that the U.S. broke the law in Kosovo. It didn't have U.N. approval, but that's because Russia used its veto, as of course it would.
That's the way it works, Shadi. I'm sorry. Right, I just said I talked a long time. I let you work, but that's the way Security Council works.
When you say break the law, it suggests something intentional and malevolent that the U.S. is deciding we're going to break the law. What happened is that the U.S. put something forward because there was an ethnic cleansing going on in Kosovo, and innocents were dying by the thousands, and the Kosovars themselves were demanding that someone step in and stop the mass slaughter of their people. I mean, I believe that when mass slaughter is going on, ethnic cleansing is going on, a genocide is going on, the world should act. It shouldn't just throw up its hands and say, well, we can't do anything because Russia has a veto in the UN Security Council. That is not a more just world. That is a world of chaos and lawlessness, if anything. So I just want to use a different kind of vocabulary and not just kind of, I don't want to concede the point that the U.S. was breaking the law there, because I think it was doing something quite good and some that saved thousands of lives. That's one thing I would say.
Let me just quickly say on that, I'm not an expert on Kosovo. I know for sure that atrocities were going on both sides, and that as usual, it's a little less simple than it's painted by the advocates of intervention. Now, I did support the Bosnian intervention, which I would say was significantly more egregious than anything that had happened in Kosovo when we finally got around to intervening. That had Security Council support. That was a legal intervention done by NATO. And, you know, as you may recall, I mean, they just took thousands and thousands of military-age males and just lined them up and shot them. Nothing, you know, look, Kosovo was bad. Atrocities on both sides. Maybe you're right, more on the Serbian side. I don't know, but...
But are you saying that the U.S. can use military power if it doesn't have Russian support? That we should allow a Russian veto on our own military?
I'm saying that if the world doesn't get to a point where they have some kind of international mechanism for authorizing the use of force, we're in deep trouble and for doing other things. And yeah, that's the mechanism I would have supported, is the Security Council. And I think in that case, I would have respected it. By the way, the Kosovo problem is still not solved. And it arguably, well, we should go into overtime. We have a public podcast, then we have an overtime that's available to paid subscribers with Non-Zero newsletter. I hope I've raised the level of attention to a point where people will be compelled to get out their credit cards just to see what's about to happen. Because Shadi, as I think you'll agree, it's going to get ugly. Right?
Yeah. Yes, maybe it will. We'll see. I can't wait.
It's going to get ugly. I promise ugliness. But seriously, the book, everyone should read the book, because it is a classic, well-argued version of a case for American power with which I happen to disagree. And it's coming out right about the time this airs. The pub date is what? November 12th?
11th, November 11th.
11th. And also the Wisdom of Crowds podcast, and Substack newsletter as well. The podcast is Substack based, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Actual newsletter. And what else? What's your Twitter handle?
Shadi Hamid. So first name, last name, and they can find my columns at the Washington Post by just searching Shadi Hamid Washington Post. And I encourage them to read more of my views there. And of course, I'd love people to take a chance on the book, even if they're skeptical. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in the book. It's intensely personal as well. It has some memoir in it. So it covers a lot of ground, and I hope people give it a chance and don't just assume that I'm wrong if they don't if they're more aligned with your view.
No, just assume that I'm right. And in cases where that does conflict with Shadi being right, yeah. But he's not always wrong. No, but actually, seriously, let me say, I've always admired, I mean, you're clearly committed. You think seriously about these things. I especially admired the stance you took. Coincidentally, it agreed with mine. On the Egyptian coup that installed Sisi that we refused to even call a coup. Right?
Exactly, right.
Much less lift the finger to stop, which we might well have been able to do. I mean, you had a democratically, you had real hope, I thought.
Yes,
you had a democratically 100%. Elected president in the wake of the Arab Spring. He wasn't the world's greatest politician, but he was more or less abiding. You know, they were on a path that might have worked out. And the military staged a coup, and we just said, fine, basically. In violation of our own laws, actually.
Yes.
In a certain sense. So I really, because a lot of people who had agreed with you on other things were not carrying the torch on that, and you were.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate
as
that.
As you made it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope everybody will follow us into overtime. Also, I just realized after pronouncing your first name correctly at the beginning, I've been pronouncing it Shadi ever since. But
it's okay. Some of my best friends call me Shadi.
Call you Shadi. Yeah. Okay. Well, I feel better. But anyway, I'm gonna try to call you Shadi, which probably isn't quite right. Anyway, okay. Thanks,
that
everybody.
That is right.
That is right. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Hope you'll follow us into overtime.